Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you're new to our podcast, welcome. Encourage you to go back and listen to some of our great guests that we've had over the last several years. And they share great lessons from their careers and leadership lessons. And this week, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had some time ago with Rich Ferrari. Rich is a seasoned healthcare entrepreneur and investor with a track record of building and scaling medical device and biotech companies. And he is a co-founder of De Novo Ventures, a premier life sciences venture firm that managed over $650 million, and he helped raise over $1 billion in capital while contributing nearly $1.8 billion in successful acquisitions. He's got some great thoughts to share. Looking forward to today's conversation with Rich. Rich, can you give us just a little bit of your story, a little bit of your career history? I'd love to hear kind of how you've gotten to where you are today.
Yeah, well, I've been in the medical device business now for 45 years, which seems like an outrageously long period of time. And it was sort of by serendipity in a sense, because my major in college was more education. So I was going down a path of being a teacher. But after I graduated, I did some substitute teaching. It wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. And then I went into the medical side and took a course, actually, at the time in nuclear medicine technology. It was almost a year course. So I actually started my career as a nuclear medicine technician, and worked. My first job was at Johns Hopkins Medical Center. And I chose Johns Hopkins specifically because it was the number one nuclear medicine center in the world. In fact, the Henry Wagner was the father of nuclear medicine, and he essentially created everything related to it. His textbook was, the thing. So I ended up working there. But while I was working there, less than a year, I realized there was a group of guys, like three, that were working in this special room that was all glassed in, and it had all these big, huge racks of computers. Now remember, this is going back into the 70s, so the computers were rather large. What these guys did was they sat in there all day long, and the Johns Hopkins had the first digitalization of like images from gamma cameras. And then they played with those things in image processing and then displayed them for Henry Wagner every morning and his review of the patients. It was really interesting. And I wanted to know, how in the world could I get into that? So I used to go in every morning at about 5 a.m. and actually taught myself how to use the computers. One of the guys in that room I got to know, and he would let me in and let me sit with him. So then I became one of those guys in the room. And that was kind of a cool shift because I was on the front end of image processing in the world of medicine. And then there's a company from California that named ADAC Labs. ADAC Labs was founded by three brilliant engineering guys at a TRW. I mean, they were way ahead of their time. And they were actually using satellites and things to transmit images. And they built one of the first image processing computers. And guess what? They decided they needed to put it in the most famous place in the United States, which was Johns Hopkins. So they gave them one. And then they sent a trainer in, who remained a good friend of mine up until her passing a few years back. So she came and she was training us, those guys in that glassed-in room, because the only guys that were computer sort of savvy, on how to use that system, which was more of a commercial system, right? So I spent 3 days with her. At the end of that, I asked her, I said, hey, Rio, what am I going to do to do what you do? Have an education degree. Maybe I could use it to teach people. She said, you know what? I'm moving to the home office. Bring your resume in tomorrow. I bring my resume in and she hired me. So I was now a computer specialist, an application specialist, as they called it back then. And I traveled all around the United States whenever a sales guy sold one of these systems to a hospital. And it was really a fun job. It's a huge increase in pay from what I was making.
Sure.
And I did that for about a year. And then, you know, all of the sales guys kept requesting me to do their demos because, you know, I sort of was pretty good at it and could really talk the talk. And I had a nuclear medicine degree. So when I was addressing their physicians, I was talking at a level that was different than their level. And this was right at the crossroads when old time sales guys, you know, the kind that would take you out to dinner, buy you drinks at the bar, you played golf with them, but they actually didn't know anything about the product. They sold more on personal relationships. We're shifting to consultative sales, where you had to really know what you were talking about. And I was right at the crossroads of that. So these sales guys kept requesting me. And I finally, after about a year of that, went to the national sales manager one day, afraid I can say, hey, listen, his name was Roger Schulte. I said, Roger, what do I got to do to get into sales? Because I'm selling all these systems for these sales guys. I'm doing all the demos. I talk to all the doctors. I close all the deals. He goes, oh, Rich, you're going to get your lunch eaten, da-da-da-da-da. Well, guess what? He goes, you know what? We have this territory that's open in Florida. Talking about Florida before we got out, right? So he said, if you don't want that territory, you see how you do, go ahead. You know, it's not one of them. So I went to Florida and make a long story short, I'll condense this down now. I was the number one salesman for 5 years in a row. Then I moved out to the home office. I got my MBA, by the way, while I was in Florida, my master's degree in business. Moved out to the home office and now was in the running the division of nuclear medicine for ADAC Labs. And that was also a tremendously interesting story because ADAC went public. It wasn't doing very well. And they brought in a turnaround artist from, at the time, Hambrick and Quist, which no longer exists. And they brought this guy in and he basically called us all out to the home office. Now I was already at the home office and he basically said, hey, well, I wasn't yet at the home office. He basically said, hey, we've got 90 days to fix the problems here at the company. We don't fix them, we shut the doors. And it's all he said. He said, I'm looking for two people. So I catch him in the hallway. His name was Mr. Prelitz, really gruff guy. I said, hey, Mr. Prelitz, were you serious about looking for two people? He said, yes. He said, who are you? I said, my name's Rich Ferrari. I've been the number one sales guy down in Florida. I could fix your problem in nuclear medicine. 20 minutes goes by. This is when they paged you over the loudspeakers and stuff. Said, Rich Ferrari, Mr. Prelitz, we'd like to see you in the president's office. So I go down there. And he goes, hey, Ferrari, this is just how we talk. He said, hey, Ferrari, he goes, I've checked up on you. You seem like a good guy. You got the job. I said, well, Mr. Prelitz, what job is that? He says, you're now vice president and general manager of the nuclear medicine division. You know, I was like 26. Right. So I said to him, Mr. Prelitz, listen, I don't know if you know it, but I actually live in Florida. This was his exact words. He said, I don't care where you live. You said you could fix the problem, fix it. So for a year and a half, I commuted from Tampa to California. Left Sundays, got home Friday nights, and I transformed their nuclear medicine division. Ultimately, I became a VP and general manager of all of ADAC. And it was at that time I felt I had learned all I needed to know from Mike. Because I had worked for him for 5 years, which was an intense experience, but a brilliant businessman and brilliant in terms of defining what matters. You know, how do you strip away everything else and really just focus on how do you make an organization run? How do you generate money for a public company? How do you do these things? And then I went off on my own. When I was 30, I got a job to turn around because I was on this turnaround team now. To turn around a lithotripsy company in Southern California, which I did in 10 months. Then I was contacted by some venture capitalists in the Bay Area, still very good friends of mine, that had this company called Cevis Cardiovascular Imaging Systems. It was the first ultrasound device at the tip of a catheter used to go into the coronary arteries. I got my first CEO job in my early 30s, raised their capital, took them public, and then sold that company to Boston Scientific. Right after that, I founded Cardiothoracic Systems, which was the fastest IPO ever, from a startup to an IPO ever in medical history. Still today, 22 years later, no one's beat that record. We pioneered off-pump bypass, which is what gave way to percutaneous valves, off-pump, and other things. Sold that company to Guidant, and then went on to build and develop another four companies, one of which was a venture capital firm called DeNovo, which we raised $650 million. I was co-founder of that. But the other medical device companies, every single one of them, I'm proud to say, were all successful, and they were all acquired. So a long history of 45 years, mostly as an entrepreneur, building and trying to create value for for the investors. So I've raised a lot of money, over $1 billion for the companies I've been involved in, and been in acquisitions now approaching $2 billion in terms of these companies that I've been on the board of and sort of helped on the acquisition or selling team.
Well, that's a great story, and you condensed 45 years into a few minutes. Great job. We talked a little bit. We met recently, and we were talking about just kind of the topics around this. And I like to ask this question to most every guest. You know, if you were able to spin back time and talk to that 22-year-old with all the experience you've had and doing what you've done, what advice would you give yourself?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I've sort of distilled it down to the following, because it's what I have seen in my own career, but also what I have advised many others to do as well, which is, and this is one of the things that came out of working for this guy Prelitz for those 5 years. It was painful, but he was brilliant in his own weird, and demanding way. But you have to quickly identify what you're good at. And that's very, very difficult for a lot of people, and I don't know that when I went into, those early days that I told you about going into Hopkins and this, I didn't know what I was good at right off the bat, but I did know I was a good talker. And I was also knew that I could take what seemed to be complex situations and distill them down to sort of simple nuggets. That was always sort of my claim to fame. So what I would encourage anyone starting out is to quickly identify what you're good at. And once you really identify that, then you put yourself into situations where you can further exploit that strength. So if it's your first job and you're working even, as an accountant or as a manager in customer service, figure out what you're good at. It might be talking. It might be solving problems. It might be articulating things in ways that others aren't. It might just be your response time. And then try to, over time, put yourself into situations where that strength can be used, where a lot of people go the reverse. They're told, work on your weaknesses. And I always viewed that as not exactly correct. I mean, I knew over time, and I still know today, what my weaknesses are, but I'm actually not very concerned about it, because over time, my strengths have become so overwhelming, it doesn't matter. And I think if you look at pro athletes and other areas, that's what they did. They focus on what they're really good at. And the other stuff, they depend on others. So that's number one. Number two is, if you're on a team, then you really need to function as a team player. Nobody on a team likes someone who is self-gratifying, constantly looking for the limelight. You get the limelight from the fact that you deliver what other people can't deliver. The fact that you deliver excellence each time you're asked to step up. And as a team member, you want to be part of that team. The bosses and the higher ups, they will see that. You don't have to worry about putting yourself out. They will see it. The other thing I would tell you is worry far less about what other people are getting paid. And again, I give you this in my own mind. I never worried about what I was getting paid in any of those positions that I mentioned to you. From the time I started at the nuclear medicine, I mean, to a certain extent, I did. Yeah, I got a salary. Great. When I got the application specialist job, okay, that salary was higher than the other one. When I came into the home office, yeah, when I went into sales, I was the lowest paid guy. But you know what? I didn't care because I figured that if I perform, and I use athletics a lot, if I perform, I will take care of that. It will take care of itself. If I worry about what other people are being made, are making, they're making more than me, I'm disgruntled. If I'm disgruntled, it's going to come out in what I do. So you don't worry about that. What you worry about is your performance and what you can do. And also, this gets to this moment of truth item. Every single interaction you have with anyone in the company and even outside of the company is an opportunity for a moment of truth. You never know what experience or what situation might be an opportunity for you to rise above everybody else. So you have to take each one of them as if that is the moment of truth. And when you think about that, it opens up your mind again to functioning in a zone where you're always performing and doing the very best you can do. And if you have that mindset, I guarantee you everything else will take care of itself.
Yeah, great wisdom. And I'm sure that'll be helpful. We've got a lot of listeners that are either in their first time leadership role or first time CEO and some great thoughts. You've led a lot of teams. You started out as a kind of individual contributor and then you worked your way up. What would you tell somebody who is maybe leading their first team? What are some things that they need to be aware of and maybe some blind spots?
Yeah, well, this is also an interesting kind of topic. And I see this, I would say relatively frequently, is that when you're a first-time leader or a first-time CEO, or let's just call it an elevated position, if you haven't figured out really what your strengths are, aren't comfortable in that area, oftentimes, and I'm sure your listeners have seen this, what happens is you try to hire people that are, you're worried that are smarter than you. So you hire people that are less because you don't want them challenging you because you're not comfortable in your own really position. And that absolutely is a massive mistake when you're building out a team. In fact, it's the opposite of that. You want to hire the absolute very best people you can recruit. Because they're not looking for your job. You're recruiting them for other positions. And first-time leaders and CEOs often think they need to know everything. They need to be good at everything. And you don't need to be good at everything. And you can't possibly know everything. So you want to hire people who are really good at what they do. And consequently, that elevates the performance of the team, right? And as a guy that's built lots of teams, and this will come no surprise because there's a gazillion statements in many, many business books, but it was one of Steve Jobs' principles, is you have to prune out, so to speak, the low performers. Because if you don't get rid of low performers every year, what happens is the rest of the organization begins to lower its bar. Or the good, really good people leave. So what happens is your organization becomes more like C players than more like A players. So always hire people who are better than you are across the board. Because it's exceedingly well proven on teams that the difference between an exceptional employee and an average employee is 10x. And if you're a team leader, what are you trying to do? Make your team look and perform to the very, very highest level. The other thing I would tell you, and I have done this throughout my career, and most recently in the last company that I was asked to run by the board of directors only a year and a half ago, which we sold for $350 million. These stories I'm telling you are exactly what I did. This company had 32 employees in it. When I got into it, I had to let 28 of them go. Why? Wasn't because they weren't good people. It was just that the needs of that organization and the skill set of the people was a mismatch. And I had to match up directionally and strategically. What did we have to get done with the best talent to get it done? And that transformed the company. And we were able to get it sold for quite a bit of money. But in that whole process, the other thing I feel very strongly about and still use it all the time is I like to have themes on within the company. And what I mean by that is something the whole organization or the team can get behind and feel like everything they're doing is contributing to the performance. I'll give you just an example. This particular company, I came up with this concept of fingerprint of success. So I took everybody's fingerprint in the company, different colors, had them all send them in. We put it on this big placard called Fingerprint of Success. And then I gave a talk to the organization of what did I mean by that? And what I meant by that is that regardless of their role inside the company, whether they were an assembler, whether they worked in documentation, whether they were in customer service, whether they were in sales, whether it was me, whether it was somebody else on the executive team, the success of the entity will only be because their fingerprint was on it. And that does an amazing amount to motivate people to come into work every day, because there's lots of places they could work, especially today, right? Companies are constantly pulling people. So why do you come into work? It can't just be for the money. You have to feel like you're making a contribution. What you're doing is making a difference. And you're acknowledged for that difference. So that's what I would tell someone who's stepping up to the plate the first time. Hire the best people you can. Create themes around what you're doing that really motivates people.
So was there something that you did during your leadership career as a CEO that you maybe did earlier or as far as in the hiring process that helped you identify those top players? Was there anything that you specifically did that helped you in that process?
Well, whenever possible, I always try, and I still do that today. My preference would be always to hire somebody I may have previously worked with, mm-hmm. or someone I know has hired that individual. Because many of these positions, you know, it does take time to find the highest quality performers. And what you don't want to do is shortchange yourself and, you know, lose patience in trying to find them. I'm always nervous with recruiters because you don't have that. I mean, they do their job and the good ones clearly are very good at it. What I mean is that you just don't have that personal interaction. So if I can get a reference around someone, regardless again of the role, you know, that this person was fantastic. Like this company, Tenon, behind me, every single person in that company is someone pretty much that I've worked with before or has worked for me in several other companies. So I know what they're capable of doing.
Sure.
So whenever possible, that would be great. So this is not hiring friends. This is hiring people, right, you know, right, are great athletes.
Yeah, right. So you've sat on boards, a number of boards and chaired boards. What advice would you give? And you've worked with boards as a CEO. I think that's one of the areas that a lot of new leaders maybe don't have the experience working with a board. What advice would you give somebody kind of in that first time working for or with a board?
Yeah. Well, again, that's another fabulous question. And I see that whether it's the first time you're working with a board or many times working with a board, CEOs, I'll go back to the statement I meant before, CEOs have to understand that their job is to not know everything. You can't know everything. Your job is to hire people that are around you that pick up and spot things that perhaps you may have missed, and where your strengths are, that's where you want to excel. Now, what creates a problem oftentimes is that a first-time CEO wants to feel like he does know it all and doesn't want to let the board down. So therefore, he presents information to the board that is, I would call it colored, with rose-colored glasses. So this gets to this talk I've given many times, which is the value of objectivity. So the number one attribute you have to have is objectivity, transparency, and you need to communicate often, particularly during difficult times. And objectivity is really very, very difficult. Most people don't want to look in the mirror and go, They're going to kind of want to sweep that away. Or a CEO may see a problem that the company is having, and in his mind, he's convinced himself that, well, by the time the next board meeting comes, we'll probably get it solved. You see, and what happens is oftentimes it isn't solved and you hadn't disclosed it at the time that you should have. Now it becomes an issue because now an astute board member will probably notice that it was a problem and they'll put you under the microscope. Well, when did you know it was a problem? Why didn't you bring it up to the board? This is a serious thing. What are you doing about it? And it starts to unravel the trust that they have in you as the CEO. And when that happens, that's a real problem. Now, the way you avoid that is to always be objective, to not put rose-colored glasses on, to not see the world that way, to see it objectively, and to always be transparent with the board. The board will always be happy to know you have outlined that there's a problem. Doesn't faze them. Because the next thing they'll want to know is, okay, understood. What's the plan of action? What are you doing to resolve it? Here's my plan of action. Okay, great. Keep us updated. Now, board meetings are usually 6-8 weeks, depends on the cadence that's set up. So, you know, in an early stage company, things are moving very, very, very rapidly. A good policy, generally speaking, is to try and provide maybe 2-paragraph, maybe 3-paragraph update for the board, maybe monthly, just letting them know, you know, since the last board meeting, you know, I told you there were a number of things that we were working on. Here's a quick snapshot of progress. That really keeps them sort of informed. The other thing that I would tell you to do is that when an issue does come up, and I'll give you a good example of one, you really, depending on the magnitude of it, you have to immediately reach out to each board member, walk them through the problem and what you're thinking, and that'll really reduce, again, the pressures. Now, this is an interesting one. This last company that I mentioned to you that I had sold for $350 million, I was on the Amalfi Coast. I can see this as if it's yesterday. You know, I had taken this little vacation. Well, consequently, I got a call from my VP and GM. We were running a clinical trial. And because we had moved manufacturing from one location to another, a decision was made between the operating group that a couple of these minor sort of tests weren't really required. So we moved the facility, came it back up to speed. However, the FDA said, wait a minute, I want to know about these two elements. And we hadn't done it. They shut the trial down.
Oh.
This is a PMA trial. They shut it down. So, you know, literally, while I'm on the Amalfi Coast, I had the car pull over. I got as much information I could from my GM and my team, and I called every single board member right then and there. I said, listen, I want to alert you to an issue. We're on top of it. I think there's a solution. This is what we believe. However, regardless of that, we're going to be delayed in our trial by about 8 weeks because there's some work we have to do, some tests we have to do, and we just simply can't get them done any faster. So I'm alerting you to the fact that our enrollment rate is going to stall. But we'll get it back. And we'll get through this. Now, could you imagine if I hadn't done that and we just went to the next board meeting and, you know, the first thing a board is going to do when you're in the midst of a clinical trial is go, hey, how's your trial enrollment going? That's kind of a major topic. And you go, well, it was going good right up until this point. What do you mean? They would have just blown the gasket. So That's a real life story, and there's many others that I have like that. You just need to be, again, objective, transparent, and communicate. You do that, boards, you'll never have a problem with a board of directors.
Yeah, you've great advice. We've had a lot of that question asked a number of times, and that was definitely something that everybody can use for sure. you're, I'm sure, a learner as far as you're continuing to learn and grow and develop as a leader. What are the books that you put at the top of others' reading lists that you think would be helpful?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give you a little pictorial to try to put in your mind because it's another topic that is very near and dear to my heart. If you think about kind of your life and you think of it as a spectrum, on, let's call it, on the left-hand side of that curve is what I would call average mediocrity. And then on the other end of that curve is excellence and exceptional like performance. And what people think is that in their careers, they sort of get to a level in their career where they become very, very comfortable. And that's a good place to be. Well, it isn't, because it's actually a physics problem. It's one of the rules of thermodynamics, I think, where you're never in one spot for very long. You're either sliding back towards mediocrity or you're moving forward towards exceptional excellence. It's just the way it is. You don't cut your lawn, the grass doesn't stay where it is. It gets higher, right? So it's going into chaos, so to speak, right? It's really the same thing with your career. So you have to have this mentality of being a continually learning machine. Continuous learning, whatever that may be, right? So you do that through learning and relationships, experiences. You take pieces away from that, from each one, people that you meet, and of course, ongoing reading or studying or videos, podcasts, other things that are all enabling you to be better at what you do. And it doesn't necessarily mean just business, right? It's about how do you become a better person, right? In all the ways you can. A healthy person, spiritually better, mentally better, right? It's not just one thing. So yeah, I would say a pretty avid reader of a number of kind of different books. My favorite, as you and I talked about earlier, clearly is my number one book for wisdom, believe it or not, is the Bible. And for those of you that might go, what are you talking about? Well, all I could tell you is that it is filled with amazing principles about how do you see things? How do you treat people? How do you run things? Remember, when I started out, I said, whatever you do, do it well. Well, that's a biblical principle. I didn't make that term up. That's exactly what Ecclesiastes says, right? This issue of objectivity, it's also a biblical principle, right? There's a whole section in the Bible that talks about how is it that you see the law, the speck in somebody else's eye, but you can't see the log in your own. That's objectivity. How is it you see the problems with everybody else, but you're just okay? You have no issues. Okay? So the Bible really is just filled with wonderful pieces of information, both for your spiritual life, your business life, your personal life. It doesn't matter. I love it. There's another great book that I'd always love, which is The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And probably many people have read it. I just loved some of the principles, and I happen to be a martial artist when I was much younger, third degree black belt. So it kind of tied to my mindset with that. But there's, again, a lot of truth inside The Art of War. For example, if you know your enemy and you know yourself, you don't need to fear the outcome of a battle. But if you don't know your enemy and only yourself, maybe every battle won, you're going to succumb to a loss, right? So there's those kind of ideas that keep your brain kind of tuned to, what do I need to know about my competition? What do I need to know about what's happening here? Another great book that Bill George, who was CEO of Medtronic, is Seven Lessons Leading Through Crisis. I love that book because that one is very analogous to my early experiences working for that guy, Mike Perlitz, I had mentioned to you, who was a really demanding, hard-driving guy. But in turnaround situations, you're always dealing with crisis. And he's got some very excellent ways of thinking about it, all objectivity related, quite frankly. Another one I just love is Team of Teams by General McChrystal. General McChrystal, if you don't know, was head of all of the armed forces most recently, only a few years back, all during the Afghanistan invasions, a Navy SEAL, and just a fabulous thinker about how do you distill things down to what's important. And he really is the one that sort of came up with, you know, we need to change the way that we're fighting with Al-Qaeda. I mean, these guys operate off of chaos. In other words, they're on cell phones and they're deploying people all over the place, and we're getting ourselves hammered. We need to have the decision processes being drilled down to the guys on the ground that can also do the same thing. We can't have it come back up the loop, go into, you know, quote, headquarters, and then come back with an answer, because that's not how they're operating down there. Really just interesting, good, interesting stuff. Another one is Straight from the Gut, Jack Welch, one of my just fabulous CEO, kind of, I can't say a mentor, but some guy I always loved, Jack Welch. If you think about when he ran GE, hard-nosed, straight shooter, built fabulous teams, totally objective and focused on what needed to get done. The Mind of the Strategist, another kind of Japanese kind of a philosophy around it by Kenichi Omai. Another, a thin book, but he just breaks down how you need to think about the key factors of success in anything you're doing, in any competitive environment or product launch or this or that. What are the key factors that really make a difference? Because there's only a couple, right? Working with Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goldman. I love that one. Because, again, if you look at the studies, the very best CEOs, they have high EQ, not so high IQ. I mean, their IQ is high, but their EQ is extremely high. They know how to deal with people. They know how to be compassionate. They know how to have empathy. They know how to drive people hard. They just have a high EQ. And then, of course, In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters is an old book as well that also just has some really, you know, guys, just wonderful insights. And there's just many other, but those are kind of like my top list that, you know, as I read those books, I could relate to the things in them. Mm-hmm. With situations that I've seen or situations that I've been in. I particularly like books that are written by military people that have become successful in something else, like business, like McChrystal. And there's a number of books actually written by Navy SEALs, because the way they approach problems, the way they think about things, how rapidly they adjust to new information and then adjust operationally what they're doing, has a lot of reality to have running business. I mean, good example. I mean, Tom Brady stands up in the line, right? Getting ready to get the ball hiked to him. He looks out, and after all these years, he can read the defense, right? That's one of his great hallmarks. But you can bet that if he sees a defense that's different than what he anticipated it would be before he's going to make that call, he is surely going to change the call, right? It's the same kind of simple principle, right?
So what are some quotes that you refer to and that you often look back on?
Yeah, I gave you one of them. I'll give it to you again. Whatever you do, do it well. I think that's just an overriding philosophy. You should just try to condition yourself to do. And I think if you do that, you'll find yourself improving. There's just in whatever it is you do. And another one that's related to that would be consistency is the secret of success. My father, who never went to college, came from Italy. It was one of the things he imprinted in my head was consistency, Rich. Whatever you're going to do, just be consistent at it. You know, if you're playing sports, consistently work hard at it. If you're going to school, consistently work hard at it. Whatever you're doing, because in the end, consistency is what's going to give you success. And I can tell you again, in my own life, when I think about it, as I'm aging, I've always liked to be physically in shape. And the only way that you can be physically in shape is to be consistent at staying in shape, right? So it's just, again, very simple principle. This is one of my favorite quotes of all time. And I'm not actually sure who said it. I want to say it was Hemingway, which really seems weird, but I think it just is, which is this. It's not what you don't know that I'm concerned about. It's what you think you know that just ain't so. You ever run across somebody who just seems like they got all the answers, and you're just going, wait a minute. You know, you're impressing me with all this other stuff, but I think it may be coloring a whole lot of other stuff. It's the stuff you don't know that just ain't, you know, you think you know that just ain't so. That's really worrying me about this plan, this activity, this situation. And another one that I think is, again, back to a kind of a biblical view kind of the world, because I think a lot of people, and I have a whole talk on this called run your race. And what I mean by that is, if you're someone, and there's lots, and I think we all have this tendency to compare ourselves to other people. You compare yourself to, I don't know, your brother or your friend. He has a higher job, a better job. He has a nicer car, a better house. He's got a vacation home. He's got this, he's got that, he's got boats. If you do that, I will tell you with 100% certainty, you are going to be an unhappy and unfulfilled person. And the reason being is because there is always somebody who has more money, better home, bigger home, more vacation properties, faster, more intelligent, better looking. If that's what your barometer is, you're just going to end up, I think, very, very very unfulfilled. And from a biblical point of view, that was what King Solomon ultimately concluded. He had everything in the world. He was richer than Elon Musk, right? He had everything, and he indulged actually in everything there was that he could indulge in. And at the end, he said, it's like chasing the wind. Mm-hmm. You can't catch it, right? And it's really true if you just think about what I just said previously. That so one thing to try and get through your heads is, instead of trying to compare yourself to others, because that will be like chasing the wind, right? Compare yourself to who you were yesterday. Because that's the only comparison that matters. And I tell you, I'm not just saying this, I do this very often, usually daily, particularly when maybe I feel I didn't approach the problem or that situation on a Zoom call or in a meeting as best I could have. How would I have done it? I could have done it better. Next time I see that, I will do it better. So compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who somebody else is.
So, Rich, what do you do to recharge when you're not working? You're involved in a lot of different things, but
Well, you can tell I've sort of touched on this sort of this, and I even used the word balancing, because I don't think it's a balance. I think it's a harmony. So what you need to do, or try to at least strive to do, is your work, your fun, your off time, all of that should kind of be in harmony with one another. Balance is too black and white, meaning that, you know, I've worked really hard, therefore I'm going to play really hard. No, it's got to be like more of an integration into your daily routines, which is, you know, what do you do when you first get up in the morning? Do you try to do some stretching or exercise or yoga or whatever? Then you start your day. Do you take a break in that day, and if you can, and do something else, and do maybe that's another activity for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. So I'm big on this. And of course, maybe it's easy for me to say after being, you know, I'm 69 and 45 years of business, that I can sort of say I've kind of figured out how to get harmony. Like that's why I'm here on Maui. I get up in the morning early. I don't have super early curls. The first thing I'm doing is my conditioning workout, because I know that that's critically important to allow me to go surf. Now, it's not a midlife crisis for me surfing. I grew up on the ocean, so I've been surfing for 55 years. But at 69, I really love going in the water and surfing the Earth's energy. But to do that, I've got to condition myself to do that. So I try to do that in the early hours. Then I come back, and then I have my business part of the day. Then I'll get a break. I may have another exercise activity, right? And then, you know, it's sort of dinner time, and I enjoy the time with when I'm home in California, my grandkids and, you know, my wife. And then in the evening, usually to wind down, I do like to read before I go to bed a little bit. Also watch a little TV, but, you know, try to read. So I think you got to work towards this sort of harmony concept. How do you integrate these things in your life so that it's just kind of smooth throughout the day, and not so much running and winding yourself up where you got tons of tension, drinking lots of coffee. It's really, you know, it really isn't going to help you in the long run, because again, think of yourself like a pro athlete. You know, they're training for specific reasons, and they're doing things for specific reasons, and that's to enable them to perform at the very highest level. So sleep is important. Exercise is important. Having activity that takes you away from that, whatever that is, biking, running, walking, you know, paddleball, stand up paddling, whatever. Those are all really critical, I think. And fundamentally, again, you know, I think you could tell, I have a strong religious belief that centers me in everything that I do. And I think that is critically important, at least for my life. That's what my North Star is. It kind of keeps me grounded in what it is that I'm doing.
Good stuff. So parting advice, what would you say to, you've said a lot of great things, but.
What I would tell you is, listen, if you're in a work situation in which you're not feeling, quote, fulfilled or rewarded, and I know I've been there, okay, in my earlier years, and you worry about, gee, what am I going to do? I'm stuck in this. Listen, there's another old quote that I didn't give you. The difference between a rut and a grave is only the dirt in your face. You can do anything you put your mind to if you focus on what your strengths are and utilize those strengths. The worst thing of all, and it happens to millions upon millions of people in the United States, is they work in a job that they are unhappy with and unfulfilled because somehow in their mind, they think that's all they could do. They can't do any better. And that's just false. That's negative thinking getting into. You can do anything you want to do. You can leave that job and find another one, especially today. They're looking to hire all kinds of people, right? You just can't waste your life that way. So I would encourage you that of all things, find situations and work and environments, friends, people where you are feeling fulfilled in what you're doing. And you will always excel at that. And you don't need to just say, that's all I can do. It's not all you can do. You just got to change your mindset.
Well, Rich, this has been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed our conversation. We could have gone on for another hour. Yeah. I know. You've got some great stories that I think we talked about this. You should put it down in a book. You've got a lot of stuff that you can, you definitely can share with those that are kind of that next generation leader, and wish you continued success in all you're doing, and enjoy the rest of the day in Maui.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark, and thank you, everyone. See ya.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.